opportunity to speak. What I hope to convince you of is that in this talk is that if the scale of inflation, the Hubble scale during inflation, is high enough with rather minimal assumptions, the CMB should be able to see whether there is any new physics between that scale of inflation and the Planck scale. So yesterday, we heard a lot of string phenomenology, which was the rather difficult attempt to simply reconstruct the known low energy effective action, and then hopefully derive, based on the uniqueness of string theory, derive some predictions as well. But you may question whether you can actually try to see whether the quantum theory of gravity is string theory as well. Now, the known reason why we don't usually think of that is that the characteristic scale of quantum gravity is very, very high. It's 10 to the 19 GeV, so just forget about building an experiment that measures that. Of course, in string theory, the Planck scale is a derived scale, and sort of in conventional string-type compactifications, you get a little bit lower. So you don't have to go all the way that high. And you may still try to ask the question, how could you test strings? Well, in the last number of years, we've seen that there may be some loopholes around this simple notion that this energy is just way too high. One is, of course, to test strings as flux tubes of gauge theories. I will not be talking about that. But another question, area where you may actually get these energies is not in a laboratory, but in nature itself. You may think about cosmic rays, or as we just heard, cosmic strings, black holes, and the area where I'll be talking about right now is early universe, or Big Bang physics, and then in particular in inflationary cosmologies. What and why inflationary cosmologies? Well, as a brief review of inflation, so inflation belongs to sort of class of FRW, expanding universes. And in expanding universes, we all know there's a gravitational redshift. If you measure a length scale at some time tf compared to an observer who measured that other length scale at time ti earlier, they're related by a redshift, which is the ratio, the scale factors. Inflation was a period in the early universe where the scale factor accelerated. And the consequence of that accelerating scale factor was that the maximal distance that a particle can travel, which is proportional to actually the inverse Hubble scale, the Hubble radius, means that this co-moving Hubble radius shrinks with time. And that meant that the particle could reach a far larger portion of the universe than if you have a non-inflationary period. And this is how inflation solves the horizon and flatness problem. But it can only do so, if you put in the numbers, if the ratio of scale factors between the end of inflation and the beginning of inflation was 60 eV. And 60 eV is a really large number. So the way, particularly in inflationary cosmology, this is relevant is that this tremendous redshift that you have between the beginning or the minimal beginning and the end of inflation to solve the horizon and flatness problem means that any present scale that we sort of measure, say GeV, was trans-Planckian, was beyond the Planck scale at the onset of inflation. Strictly speaking, that actually means that you can't trust anything you're doing anymore. There are energies occur in the game for which general relativity is no longer a valid description. So you should try to actually discuss this in a string theory in an expanding background. That would be a very interesting question. We don't really know how to do string theory in an expanding background. But you may turn this problem around and turn it into perhaps an opportunity. The fact that you need this tremendous large number of e-folds to solve the flatness and horizon problem may mean that if all the predictions that we measure in the current high precision cosmological measurements maybe they reflect some of this very, very high skill physics that is transmuted to the present day features. So there's a window of opportunity which says that maybe present day features measure trans-Planckian characters. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so there is a crucial part in this argument, right? That of course there is no disturbances of any of your characteristic features between now and then, right? It really means that the physics that happens at the inflationary scale is not disturbed by late time physics, because anyway, it would wash out any earlier information. Okay, so in an inflation, that's a subtle. No, that's not my point. So there is a second ingredient in the story, which says that which is required that any of the early time physics that you're trying to measure here is completely undisturbed in its current day measurements. So an inflation, the inflationary perturbation spectrum that we measure. So this is a very quick argument, okay? But no. Exactly. Yeah, that's the whole point. The whole point is that the CMB physics actually is determined during the phase of inflation, and electron physics is not. So the CMB physics that's being measured, as we all know from these graphs, right, this is determined during that phase of inflation.
The very physics you wrote down in the Hubble expansion plate, you assume that there is a classical physics to start with.
Yes, so I'm saying that that assumption maybe has to be revisited.
You're making an assumption, you're getting inflation, and then you're saying that, well, I mean, you know, my assumption was not correct. Is that your point? I just want to understand.
Exactly, exactly. So, right, so you have to revisit the whole story.
And how can you trust the number that in 16 Coulombs, 17 Coulombs, the very first point? You've got to be careful.
That's the whole point. The whole point is that when you. Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Okay. So the point is that the temperature fluctuations that are observed in the CMB, here plotted in a multipole spectrum, use as input primordial Gaussian power spectrum, roughly meaning constant variance. And in inflation, this primordial power spectrum is simply Gaussianity due to zero-point quantum fluctuations. And the measured fluctuations actually are the ones that occur around 50 to 40 e-folds before the end of inflation. And then they freeze out. In the standard scenario, nothing happens to them. So they really imprint features of the inflationary phase. They do get redshifted, and then we measure them. So in particular, if you have a very long period of inflation, these fluctuations get redshifted very, very far back. And that's when you have this Trans-Planckian problem in severe. If you have short periods of inflation, you actually can get away with not running into this Trans-Planckian problem. To that maybe addresses your question. So how can you do better? Well, general relativity, as we know, is an effective field theory below the Planck scale or below any scale of new physics M. So when you ask the question, do present-day cosmological features reflect some Trans-Planckian characteristics? Within effective field theory, it's a slight misnomer because you can't really tell what the scale of new physics is. You just need any new physics beyond the scale where you trust your theory. If you now make a very simple phenomenological approach, which you simply say that any time your momenta reaches this cutoff scale, you should stop trusting what's going on, And then you demand that at this smaller scale, you simply have flat space, right? Because this is a scale higher than the Hubble scale during inflation. You do find, if you compute this power, this primordial power spectrum, that there are new effects, and they're encoded in expansion of the Hubble scale during inflation over the scale of new physics. And in a very simple, optimistic, but rather typical inflationary scenario, you can get scales of inflation which are 10 to the 14 GeV. If the scale of new physics is indeed a little bit lower than the Planck scale, 10 to the 16 GeV, this is of order 1%. And these are sizes that are detectable in future high precision experiments, CMB. Now, this was a rather phenomenological approach. We know a more sophisticated, more advanced approach if we really can encode the effects of high energy physics in irrelevant higher derivative operators corrections to general relativity. When you do that on the back of an envelope, you run into a problem because the leading term that you would write down for a scalar field needs two extra derivatives. Therefore, the suppression factor that you need to get dimensionally correct is twice the scale of new physics. Therefore, you expect that the leading effect is of order momentum squared over m squared. The characteristic scale of the momenta that you measure in inflation is roughly the inflationary horizon size. And therefore, this effect is twice suppressed compared to these phenomenological models. And these percentages, if the effect is of order 1/10,000, are unobservable. They're really unobservable. They're statistics limited. There's no way on Earth we would ever be able to observe them. So the question, do present-day cosmological features reflect new physics, is really to first approximation and rough question, is the effect linear or quadratic in the new scale? And there was a point at which you, in the phenomenological approach, where you made some choice that you demanded that at this cutoff scale, you recovered flat space. Now, this isn't related to a very well-known problem in quantum field theory in an expanding universe, is that the vacuum is, quantum vacuum is no longer well-defined. There's a vacuum ambiguity. In an expanding universe, the energy density is not a global quantum number, so the minimum energy state is not really a clear notion. Now, this has been a well-known problem for years. There have been books written about it. And so the question, and there's been a standard solution to this problem. And the way you can interpret this phenomenological approach earlier is that they simply chose a non-standard initial state. Now, why do people always consider this standard case? It's the reason that these non-standard vacua that turn out to have some problems that nobody was really able to resolve convincingly. I will say that there was no unambiguous solution that the standard vacua were the consistent ones. But the problems that appeared is that these non-standard vacua were difficult to square with decoupling because they tend to be non-local at the scale h of the expanding universe. And that's not what you expect in an effective field theory. You expect this to be at a scale m. And in particular, another thing that happens in these non-standard vacua is that the back reaction, if you compute the one-loop back reaction in these non-standard vacua and you subtract the standard flat space counter term, you find a divergent answer. And because that appeared at these non-standard vacua, some other non-renormalizable, which seems very strange. On the other hand, if you construct explicit examples where you have various phase transitions in the early universe, you actually find that for the later phases, effectively, the system isn't one of these non-standard vacua. So this seems to be rather contradictory. And what we'll do here is resolve that conundrum. So to do that, we have to first do a small translation. The usual problem is phrased in terms of vacuum conditions or initial state conditions, which is natural in Hamiltonian language where you discuss operators. However, effective field theory, which emphasizes decoupling and symmetries, is more naturally formulated in a Lagrangian formalism or path integral formalism. Now, we all know that in the Hamiltonian system, the vacuum corresponds to boundary conditions in the Lagrangian formalism. So what we are able to show is that any, with some small, small restrictions, boundary conditions, you can incorporate actually in a boundary action. So you simply add a boundary action to your theory, and then varying that theory, you recover whatever boundary conditions you wish. And then moreover, the location of this boundary action is to first order arbitrary. So actually, wherever you put this boundary action, it doesn't necessarily need to have a meaning. And then, as most of you know, boundary actions are subject to renormalization, just as bulk actions are. And when you apply this to cosmology, you have to first check, oh, this is not coming through very well, that you recover the known boundary conditions, and you can compute the corrections to the CMB spectrum. So let me, am I really losing all the green? Okay. Can someone quickly upstairs help me here? Otherwise, we're in trouble. Nobody? OK. So if you can see the red, then what happens is that we know that the boundary actions are subject to renormalization. This has been long known. But in particular, that means if you work in an effective field theory, that you should be able to write down irrelevant boundary operators. So with some small assumptions, that's with our assumption that I mentioned before, that in these, there's no intrinsic scale to the boundary action, which is different from the bulk action. Or in cosmological terms, it simply means that you have a homogeneous and isotropic boundary action. These are the leading irrelevant operators that you can write down. And you can already see a big difference with the bulk effect of operators. It is linear in the suppression scale M. When you now apply this to cosmology, what this does for you, it simply parameterizes your cosmological vacuum ambiguity. You don't have to solve this problem. You can simply parameterize anything that you want, go to your favorite cosmological data gathering team, and ask them, what are the boundary conditions in the universe? Moreover, this is a space-like boundary, yes. So that's a very subtle question, which I will not go into in this talk, but in our articles we discussed this in detail. So moreover, any of these boundary conditions is consistent. You can go beyond these Hadamard boundary conditions, which have no back reaction problems. Particularly, you can recover, of course, the known boundary conditions. And the effects on the CMB are as follows. You can simply compute the power spectrum, and you get the following result. In particular, here you see a term which is linear, the Hubble scale during inflation over M. Now, of course, when you compute this, there are sort of, when you change your theory, there are maybe other phenomenological constraints. We've computed those as well. Phenomenological back reaction constraints. So these are not consistency constraints. These are simply the fact that when you add quantum corrections to your theory, you must make sure that you don't deviate too far from the classical solution. They are rather mild. So let me go briefly through some details for you. So in simple scalar field theory, if you add lambda 5-4 theory, you can add a boundary action which is of the following type. You have a normal derivative here and then quadratic coupling. And these are power counting or normalizable couplings. The calculus of variations gives you the equations of motion plus two extra equations. One is clearly a boundary condition. But the second one, you have to be a little bit more careful. This is the normal derivative of variation, which at least classically seems to tell you that this boundary coupling mu cannot appear for consistency. It must be zero. Classically, this is correct. But quantum mechanically, you can create counter terms that are of this type. You have to be a little bit more careful. But you can remove all these couplings by field redefinitions. Mu is a redundant operator. And if you change the couplings kappa accordingly, you can describe the same physics, which only has coupling of this type. So the boundary conditions that this action describes are following simple type. The normal derivative of phi at the boundary is related to the value of phi of the boundary by this boundary coupling constant kappa. Now this boundary location is rather arbitrary. Remember that what you're trying to do is solve a second order differential equation, which is the equations of motion, and there are two solutions. The boundary conditions simply tell you what is the linear combination of solutions that describes the physics that you're interested in. This is the relevant number. What is the linear combination of solutions that the physics are described? It's related to the boundary coupling constant as follows. But it means that as long as I leave this number B unchanged, all the physics that I will describe is the same. So there is a symmetry where if I change the boundary location, remember that this B depends on the boundary location in a certain way, if I adjust the coupling accordingly such that this number remains unchanged, all physics is invariant. So the location where I put this boundary action need not actually have a meaning. Now, what happens in cosmology? So let me very briefly tell you. So we're considering FRW universes or Sitter universes in the conformal gauge, so the scale factors is up front. You can solve the field equation exactly, and this is one solution, and the second solution is complex conjugate. And there's one subtlety, is that the boundary condition, which involves a normal derivative, involves the factor of the scale factor. Now you can see what kind of boundary conditions you can treat here. You can simply covariantize sort of flat space boundary conditions, where this coupling k is simply minus I omega, omega being the frequency minus the spatial momentum squared plus m squared, by introducing an extra scale factor. And that's certainly a valid choice of boundary conditions, which has not appeared in the literature before. However, they're interestingly related to these shortest length boundary conditions that people in the phenomenology in this simple pictorial picture, that whenever the momentum scale k, the physical momentum scale, reached the cutoff scale, that's when you should stop testing your theory. These boundary conditions that they considered correspond to these harmonic oscillator boundary conditions, but except that the momentum-dependent location is enough. Now remember that the location didn't really matter. You can find an equivalent representation at a different location as long as this number b is the same. In this case, b is constant. That's this particular form. We'll come back to us in a moment. So there's a nicer interpretation where b follows from a momentum-independent boundary location, eta naught prime, where it has this rather complicated coupling. Of course, the standard Bunch-Davies vacuum choice is also present in this picture. The Bunch-Davies boundary conditions are roughly defined that they should reproduce the Minkowski propagator for very, very high momentum much higher than the curvature scale. This corresponds in the basis that I've chosen, it's a convenient basis, to b is zero. So you can simply invert the relation between b and the boundary couples kappa to find that this is the relation for them. Now this is not, this is a slight misnomer, this is a sort of pseudo-local operator. There's no scale in this operator, but it involves square roots of the spatial momentum. So, and indeed for very high momenta, you find that the boundary coupling constant that corresponds to Bunch-Davies reproduces the Minkowski harmonic oscillator boundary conditions. Now there are many other boundary conditions that you can consider, but particularly from this point of view, boundary action, the fixed points of RG flow will be very interesting. But I'm not going to say much more about that. What I am going to say is that this initial assumption that you can construct the Bunch-Davies extension by going to very, very high momenta is, of course, changed when you consider effective actions. In particular, these cosmological effective actions, the naive idea is that they always break down at something called the Planck time, which is 1 over the Planck mass. And here you see this almost appear directly. The effective bulk action is an expansion in momenta over the scale factor at any particular time. So this gives you simply that all the physical momenta at any time must be less than the cutoff scale. But there's now a second expansion, is that the effective boundary action is an expansion of the co-moving momenta over the scale at the location of the initial condition. So we have two expansions. You can consider one as an energy expansion and a second simply as a constraint on the earliest time. The maximum momentum that you measure in your experiment gives you an earliest time that you can trust your effective action. And this is despite the presence of the shift symmetry. Now we can answer the question, what happens to the CMB? So if you look at the leading irrelevant operators in this boundary action, which are one order of magnitude less than the bulk expansions, they are of this type. there are two terms with normal derivatives which can be removed by this field redefinition. So you have an effective boundary coupling constant projection. It looks like this. And the power spectrum of density fluctuation is simply the spontaneous pair creation from the vacuum. So you take your one loop vacuum polarization, you cut it in the middle, take the imaginary part, and then you find the normal formula that you find in cosmological textbooks. Of course, since we have an action, we don't have to do that. We can actually compute it all by standard Feynman diagrams. There's nothing mysterious in this computation. You just have to do it. It is rather complicated. But you find that the power spectrum is given by this formula, where this is the Bessel function that solves the wave equation. And this number k effective is this whole combination. And again, you see linear h over m correction that you would expect from a change in the initial conditions. Now, I'm going to only mention it very briefly, but in this case, let me just move to the summary, is that the back reaction in this case is completely under control. So remember, there are theoretical issues with the back reaction, because the conventional wisdom was that only the Hadamard states are consistent initial conditions in cosmology. The Hadamard state, by definition, is if you compute the one loop correction to the stress tensor, you subtract the Minkowski space counter term, you find a finite answer. In this boundary action formulation, however, you have new boundary couplings. They can absorb additional divergences that you find. So there's a far larger class of initial conditions that you can consider in this boundary action formulation than in the conventional wisdom. Now, that does not mean that back reaction is unimportant, because, of course, if you change your initial conditions, you may change the finite value of the back reaction, so the phenomenological part. Now, for small deviations from the Bunch-Davies initial state, which is the one you choose because it reproduces the current measurements rather well, you actually find that the first order in this small parameter beta back reaction is localized. This is a rather subtle computation, but therefore it is localized on this boundary action. For the bulk cosmology, for the time that is far beyond these initial conditions, of course, this doesn't matter if you have a localized energy density. So therefore, this does not affect the effective cosmological evolution of the universe. The second order constraint, however, does affect. But because it's second order, there's only a constraint on beta squared, and it's roughly of the following type. There's some numbers of pi here, which I'm not giving you, but you can find in our articles. And this number beta squared must be smaller than the Hubble scale during inflation, Planck scale squared over the new scale to the fourth. And this is a rather weak constraint. It's weak precisely because it has a second order constraint. Now, on the first talk, we heard something about an LHC stretching exercise. But now that we know that string theory might appear in cosmology as well, maybe we should do some cosmo-calisthenics as well. Calisthenics is a rhythmic exercise without apparatus. So, and the rhythmic is rather appropriate, because what happens when you change these initial conditions, is that you characteristically find an oscillatory component on top of the zeroth order Bunch-Davies corrections. So what happens is simply it's a feature of mode mixing. When you take the scalar field phi and you decompose it in the Hamiltonian formalism in two modes, one of these modes you can consider as the positive frequency mode, one as the negative frequency mode. And precisely for the Bunch-Davies, they don't mix. But when you choose an initial condition which is different from the Bunch-Davies, there's some mixing between them, which causes an interference effect. Now, there are two types of boundary conditions that sort of are of interest. One is simply what this boundary EFT gives you. And that means that the symmetries for the initial condition are only restricted to the homogeneity and isotropy of the background as well. And you find that this B, this number that determines the physics, is the following combination. You note that rather crucially, the homogeneous solution to the field equation appears here, and also it grows with the momentum. The shortest length boundary conditions, which many people considered before we constructed this boundary FT, are a non-generic subset of this. Because what they do, they impose an additional symmetry remember, in effective field theory, if you pose additional symmetries, then your generic predictions are no longer valid. They impose homogeneity as sort of the end, sort of near scale invariance. They demand that the in pure de Sitter space, this number b is a constant. Or in other words, b can only depend on the spatial momentum through the Hubble constant. Okay. And you find that the generic class of initial conditions is the following four. You need this exponential factor to actually avoid the non-localities on the scale h that a generic initial condition is there. And then this is simply the fact that at zeroth order you want to reproduce by Davies. Now, you can then simply plot what these two, the consequences of these two conditions should be for the power spectrum. Make a table. So the generic feature is an oscillatory characteristic, so there's some oscillation part and there's an amplitude. But the behavior between the oscillation of the period and the amplitude is very different for the two models. In the one case, there's a growth, in the boundary effective field theory, there's a growth with k, just as you expect with from any irrelevant operator. It should start, it should become more important the higher the momentum is. And the other thing is that in the boundary effective field theory, the period is simply linear. Whereas in the shortest length boundary condition, because this is a scale invariant theory, or near scale invariant theory, it actually turns out that the periodicity is logarithmic in k. So that is the main qualitative difference between the two. The amplitude is here measures, moreover, directly the scale ratio scales h over m. So in both cases, there is a linear suppression in m, and you expect to observe this if this scale h over m is small enough. And preliminary studies of actual data deconvolutions do seem to indicate that if this scale is large enough, you should be able to decipher these new physics. Now, there's one piece that I should say is that you can make this in a rather interesting statement, because what happens in your, when you measure the CMB is you measure both the spatial curvature fluctuations, those are the ones that everybody shows the nice plots of. But these are actually related to these power spectrums by that we are computed by an extra factor of the slow roll parameter. They enhance the amplitude of this spectrum. And what you measure is that this number is of order 10 to the minus 10, or in fact, h over m times the slow roll parameter is 10 to the minus 5. If you measure primordial gravitational waves, or the B modes that Henry was talking about, if you can decipher them from other contributions to the B modes, you measure this ratio of the scale of inflation in units of the Planck scale directly. If you now correlate this with the requirement to see these C and B, these oscillations on top of the spectrum, you simply find that as if you measure primordial gravitational waves, H over M generically is large enough to also account for these oscillatory signatures if you assume natural. Because that means if you assume that these coefficients, three coefficients, beta and beta tilde, are of order one. So let me conclude. If you just want to discuss initial states on the field theory, you can do that by a boundary action, whose location to first order is arbitrary. And the scaling behavior induces boundary RG flow and boundary irrelevant operators. And you can try to figure out how high-scale physics affects the initial conditions. When you apply this to cosmological vacuum selection, you would, of course, guess that the preferred boundary conditions are RG fixed points. We haven't investigated this in detail yet. But you can simply parameterize all the known types of solutions. And no matter which, generically, there are H over M type corrections to the CMB power spectrum of fluctuations. Can we actually decipher these corrections? Well, if H over M is indeed of order 1%, or in a physical terms, if we see primordial gravitational waves, then there's a large chance that there's a large reason to actually look for these oscillations in the scalar power spectrum. There are interesting connections with holography, which involves boundary theories. And one question is that it may address questions, is there really an earliest time in cosmology? Is there really some notion of the Planck time in effective field theory? Now, the final question is, of course, this was also asked of Henry, is what can this tell us about string theory? if observed, can we say something about string theory or quantum gravity? Well, what you observe, of course, is the effect of the leading irrelevant operator in a low energy effective action. And the most you can deduce from that is simply the scale m of new physics. And you can't really say whether the scale is string theory or intermediate gut physics or any other physics that happens between the scale of quantum gravity and this Hubble scale during inflation. So to distinguish these various models, you need more information. However, remember the lore at the beginning that you can't measure strings or this type of physics at all. So you should simply be patient and gather your information one piece at a time. And this would be one more piece of information that we didn't have before. I would like to end with that. Well, this is exactly what I'm actually trying to do is, in some sense, precisely answer your question. In a non-trivial curved background, how does effective field theory work? Because you have to worry a lot about redshifts, which you don't have in Minkowski space time. So you already see some notions of a literal mathematical manifestation of a Planck time. This boundary action is a second expansion in derivatives. And you can try to make that more manifest. That is simply what we're trying to do. We're trying to do effective field theory with a fixed cutoff scale m in a curved expanding background and see what implications that might have for the CMB. There's not much more into that. The infrared physics should be very weakly coupled to gravity, and in particular, that is not. Yes. So a big question is the natural initial conditions that you might want to consider are indeed the fixed points of our G flow, the real infrared fixed points. That is assuming that there's been time enough for the system to relax to its ground state. We don't know exactly what those are in the system. There is a clear candidate, which is Dirichlet boundary conditions, but those are clearly not present in the measured CMB. The Bunch-Davies works very well. So what we're simply doing is a phenomenological approach. But why would IR part be relevant? General relativity is a non-renormalizable theory. It's precisely the high K modes where gravity is strongly coupled that you can't trust it. No, I don't think so. let me put it this way. If you look at you have to put initial conditions on your wave equation to solve this. The usual argument that people choose Bunch-Davies is that if you go infinitely far back in time, everything should reduce to the tremendous blue shift reduces everything. So in a de Sitter that's correct, but in a non de Sitter universe that's not correct. Actually, in this formalism. To first approximation, the Bunch-Davies state is just as fine-tuned as any other state. Yes. I'm not sure I understand your question. I'm simply doing effective field theory, assuming that there's a quantum gravity and characterizing all irrelevant operators. And generically, the UV physics can affect the initial conditions as well. Yes. Well, that is an assumption. The assumption is that the scale that this boundary condition involves, that whatever scales there are in the initial state are certainly smaller than the Planck scale. That means that anything non-local I add with that scale, I can always expand in local operators of the lower scale. Okay, so it involves square root of the spatial momentum k, but actually when you work with it, you can actually compute everything because there are no poles in the physical region. So it's, I don't really know to what extent that's local or non-local. I only know that computationally it works. You could, but that is a good question. I don't know a more detailed answer to that. Well, okay, so a counterexample would be is if you have a very non-trivial IR fixed point, it would certainly make sense to add higher derivative corrections to that, and then the fact that that guy in itself has a non-trivial scale ought not to be a problem, because the fact that it's a non-trivial IR fixed point means that it's stable to corrections that are suppressed by momenta over m, the new scale. Yeah. So as I said, that is an assumption in this game. Yeah. So there's the small star that I mentioned is roughly the fact that you do make this assumption. You could certainly choose an inhomogeneous initial state. This is part of the assumption. We've assumed that this state respects the same symmetries of that the bulk physics does. But you can repeat this whole formalism and put in extra inhomogeneities in the initial state. That means that you would break more symmetries in effective field theory language than you have imposed. Then all these predictions would no longer hold because they're primarily based on the effects of the symmetries that you impose on the initial conditions. A physical reason why you might choose the most symmetric state is that to some extent this should be a state that is close to whatever you call the vacuum or the ground state, which you assume is more symmetric than any other state. But there's no reason beyond that to make that assumption. It's our personal preferential input. for the tensor mode. So in principle, you could choose a different set, or you could change them by a different irrelevant, or the different strength of the irrelevant operator. Although naturally, it would also be of this order one. So naturally, it would be of the same order, but it could be differing slightly. So there, one of the consequences of this is that in single field inflation, there is a consistency condition between the scaling of the tensor and the scalar power spectrum. But if you choose those coefficients different, you would break that symmetry. This has been discussed even before we did this formalism, that generically these trends or these new physics effects would break that consistency condition between scalar and tensor scaling of the power spectrum.